The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Now it's Culture Club time, and it's 30 years since the world was first exposed to Riverdance during the interval of the Eurovision Song Contest in 1994. The stage musical that grew from that won a Grammy Award in 1997 and continues to be performed around the world today, including in its current run just across the road in the Gaiety Theatre, Dublin, which ends on September 8th, I believe. To date, almost 25 million people have seen Riverdance, the show, live. As a producer in the studio, my next guest has worked with U2, Van Morrison, Kate Bush, Richard Harris, the Dubliners, Planxty, Andy Irvine, Davy Spillan, and he is, of course, the great Bill Whelan. Bill, you're very welcome to Culture Club on The Last Word.
Thank you very much, Mary. Great to be here.
It's like this is your life with records.
Okay.
You know, and I know you could have made many, many, many choices. But listen, before we start your choices, I mean, it's now 30 years since that fateful date.
It is.
In 1994. Yeah. Can you tell me about the frenzied lead up to that? I know that it wasn't plain sailing for you to create that piece of music.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. It was, I mean, the run up to the original Riverdance, the 7-minute piece at Eurovision, actually, in a funny kind of a way, it was calm. You know, there seemed to be a great sense of calm in the O2 when we were doing it. And then as we went through the week of rehearsals, we began to realise that there was quite a frenzied response from just the people who were, you know, from other countries who were in the Eurovision. Mm. And then by the end of the week, they were all attending our, deliberately coming to our rest rehearsals. And then, of course, there was the night, which, I mean, we kind of knew at that stage that this was having an effect, but then nothing prepared us for the night. The night was unbelievable. I mean... just immediate standing ovation. It was great, but it was actually calm. It was a lot calmer than when we went on to do the full 2-hour show that now tours the world, and still is, and it's in the Gaiety at the moment. And just come back from China. Mm. I mean, who knew, Mario? You know that, you know, 30 years later we'd be talking about Chinese tours and stuff.
You know, and tributaries.
Exactly.
Of Riverdance.
Little rivulets. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What, like, Ian Dempsey plays this piece of music, plays Riverdance, you know, but once a year on his breakfast show, which is a pop music show, ostensibly. And every time we play it, because I'm in front of it, I can see an avalanche of text messages. Right. It's not just nostalgia. The music does something to people. And it's not just recalling a particular place and time. It has something in it. I mean, you are having and have had an amazing career, but there's something about this piece of music. Can you identify what it is yourself? What is it about the piece of music that excites us so much?
It's a great question, and it's difficult for me to answer. I read an interview the other day with Belinda Murphy, who was one of the dance captains, the very original Riverdance when we did it back at the Point, and she said, you know, Michael and Jean came in, and they were all kind of just limbering up and stuff, and she said, and then we heard the music, and she said, it was like nothing we'd ever heard before, and I think the reason was is that. I think Riverdance is structured in a way that it's theatrical. In other words, it's not like a set of jigs and reels where you play the jigs and reels and they go around. This slowly starts with a choir, then it leads into a slip jig, and then it leads into a part that has quite broken rhythms. Mm. And then it all the time it's moving theatrically forward. Mm. So the 7-minute piece has a line, has a narrative. It's like a story. And it delivers that moment when the big line comes together of dancers. And that's an emotional moment. I mean, I go in and I see the show. I'll go in tomorrow night now.
Will you?
And I still get a buzz.
Yeah.
You know, there's just something about the combination of the excitement of the music and then the dance coming together in that way. And it was deliberately staged by Mavis Ascott, who did the staging choreography for Riverdance. It was deliberately staged so that it was theatrical. It started slow and then it built, and then she delivered. You know, I'd worked with her before, and she, you know, that line was a favourite of hers. I mean, she had done it before, but not with Irish dance. And it was that great delivery of that theatrical moment, I think, that really did it. I mean, That's about all I can say. I mean, it's still there.
But there's something in it, just briefly, there's something in it un-Irish as well. It's Irish, but there's something of, I don't know, the Middle East as well in it. There's something, do you get me?
Yeah, I absolutely get you. And, you know, it's funny that you use the word because I did an album a couple of years previous to that called East Wind,
okay,
which was a connection, which was Irish. It was Davy Spillan and Andy Irvine playing basically Eastern European music, but we'd sort of infused jazz into it because there's a big, you know, jazz is very rhythmic, as you know, and complex rhythms do inform jazz, and getting that Eastern European music and jazz and putting them together was a kind of a hint to what we might be able to do in Riverdance. And I deliberately tried to make that connection. And even the lineup of instruments are very similar in Riverdance to what I'd used in East Wind.
Mm. Well, I try to always make connections with my guests, Bill, whoever I'm talking to. And of course, my guest, my connection with you may be tenuous, but it's real.
Okay.
And that connection, of course, is both of us. Yes. Both of us are inextricably linked with Michael Flatley.
Yeah.
And of course, you are inextricably linked with Michael Flatley. And I have Flatley in my locker as one of my party pieces. Was it tough to work with?
We had our moments. I think, you know, and the tension that leads up to something like this, there's definitely, you know, there are moments when personalities can rub off each other, and we did have our moments, but we've moved on, and there it is now, and he's out there doing his own thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, amazing, Bill, and of course, a storied career you have had and are having. But you're here, of course, to discuss your culture picks in this culture club, and one of the picks we start off with first is the first single you ever brought. Now, I mean, like, people could answer this in a number of different ways, and you said you could have answered it seven different ways. But what have you chosen?
The first single, you know, I didn't bring my note with me. What did I choose?
Oh, you chose, tell it to you. You chose Elmer Bernstein's.
Oh, yes, of course. Elmer Bernstein's, you know, Elmer was a fantastic film composer. And I remember the first time I heard the theme from The Magnificent Seven.
Mm.
It was that rhythmic thing that Elmer has as well. The dum 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 dum.
Okay.
Dum, dee, 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 and I just heard that. And as a kid, it immediately caught my ear. And there was a record that came out in the UK by a band called the John Barry Seven. And it was a single.
Mm.
And that was the first single I remember coming into the house.
Okay.
Elmer and Elmer's music and the John Barry Seven playing it.
Okay. Let's hear a clip from The Magnificent Seven.
Sure.
John Barry Seven with The Magnificent Seven, the theme, based on the theme to The Magnificent Seven. And of course, The Magnificent Seven was an incredible movie at the time. And Elmer Bernstein as well, Bill, did the theme, do you remember, for Cape Fear and The Great Escape.
And not alone that, Mario, but he ultimately was to become a good friend.
Yeah?
Yeah, Elmer Bernstein and I did quite a bit of work together because I did, in the 1980s, I went out to California on Elmer had come in to do the score for My Left Foot in Ireland.
Ah.
And we met. Previously, I had done a thing on the music of Sean O'Rea, which Elmer conducted. And that's when we met first. And then when My Left Foot came up, he came in and conducted it and wrote it, obviously, and conducted the score. And I put the orchestra together for him. And that started. He got a great idea then. He said to me, you know, Ireland is a great place, he said, with great studios, great musicians. Why don't we see if we can interest the American composers in coming to Ireland?
Mm.
So he assembled a group of composers in California, including people like, believe it or not, Henry Mancini, John Williams Agency, all these people all turned up. And he told them about, I brought out a video of the orchestra, and we told them about recording in Ireland. And the result was that by the time I moved on to do something else, we had recorded 50 film scores in Ireland with Irish musicians. Mm. And that was the connection to Elmer.
I remember the, now that you mention it, I remember the soundtrack from My Left Foot. And I remember it was it was quite haunting. There was a whistle in it.
It was an onde martineau.
Is that what it's called?
Yes, it's an electronic instrument. The weirdest thing.
Yes.
It was used a lot in contemporary classical music. Yeah. And Elmer was a big fan of that, and he used it on a number of scores. But the first one I think that he did was My Left Foot.
Yeah. You're a person who composes music. Elmer is obviously a composer. I'm fascinated by this. Have you ever listened to a piece of, let's say, film composition and gone, that's the one. That's the one I wish I had written.
I nearly always have that feeling when I hear Thomas Newman scores. I mean, he's just such a great composer.
Yeah.
You know, he's done so many great films, American Beauty, you know, just those. He's very subtle. You know, it's not a big brash score ever.
Is the American Beauty that kind of Glockenspiel?
Xylophone.
Xylophone.
Vibes. Mm. Every time I hear him, and of course Ennio Morricone, again, very atmospheric composer, Elmer, God, there were so many great American composers. When film composition actually was in a far more forward position than it is now. Now you could have tracks by Sting put in on the film and, you know, whereas in those days, it still happens, but not as much. The composer was almost like a designer. He was he was the last welder on the ship, is what William Goldman referred him to. So the composer comes in when the whole thing is finished, and then he adds that extra dimension.
I know.
Yeah,
I've seen footage of Spielberg working with John Williams, and they're observing the footage of E.T.
Yeah.
And they're going, so I need to write this little bit for when his reaction shot and he looks up at the spaceship, it needs to go, wah, then at that moment.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And that, by the way, that's called spotting. Mm. So the two of them sit down and spot it. And it's, you know, sometimes you can conspire with the editor to give a kind of a false, you can, let's say, introduce a note of kind of ominousness that maybe leads the audience off in the wrong direction.
Okay.
Deliberately, you know, that. So it is, it becomes another actor in the film.
Let's move on to your favourite album, Bill. And what have you chosen?
I chose, a tough choice, but one of the albums that was really, really, I listened to so much in my 20s was Joni Mitchell's Court and Spark.
Yeah.
I mean, she remains, and she's still with us, thankfully, but she is such an unbelievable deliverer of songs that are musically complex, poetically complex, and, you know, she broke all kinds of rules and modes.
Yeah,
I think so. More than many of the guys that were writing at the time. You know, she was in a unique position as a female writer and writing those beautiful songs that she did. And Court and Spark, she'd moved away from the pure kind of folk, you know, guitar-led songs that were all over the Blue album and, you know, stuff like that, and had come in to work with Los Angeles session musicians. Mm. And the arrangements were more complex, and that was ultimately to lead her off into jazz and the Mingus album. But I just love this album, and I listen to it a lot.
Let's hear Free Man in Paris from this album.
Trying to be a good friend of mine.
Go on, Bill.
Yeah, this, well, first of all, the band, she had formed an association with the LA Express, Tom Scott and the LA Express. And this song is written about a well-known music producer who, you know, was spending all his time developing acts, forming record labels, David Geffen.
Oh, yeah.
And she was a good friend of his, and she wrote this. But there's a one great line in it. She says, I was a free man in Paris. I was unfettered and alive. There was nobody calling me up for favors. No one's future to decide. I can go back there tomorrow. But for the work I've taken on, stoking the star maker machinery behind the popular song. What a great line.
Yeah, brilliant.
Isn't it?
Yeah, brilliant. Her lyrics are amazing. I love The Circle Game.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, about growing up, life, this, the evolution of life.
Yeah.
You know, brilliant. Okay.
And Both Sides Now.
Both Sides Now. Her singing that last year, you know.
I know.
You know, fantastic. Yeah. Still going. Yeah. Your favourite band or artist? And I'm, excuse my ignorance, Bill. I've never heard of this man.
Brad Meldow.
No.
Oh. Brad Meldow, amazing jazz pianist. But what I love about him is he's not alone just got a beautiful pianistic style. He's made loads of albums, but he's also done these incredible collaborations. And one of my favorite albums of his is with Chris Thiel from Nickel Creek. And they play things like Tour Them the Love.
Okay.
You know, yeah. And it's beautifully arranged, beautifully played. A great guy.
Here's Brad Meldow playing Paranoid Android by Radiohead.
Okay. Yes.
Lovely, Bill.
Mm.
One of the things we haven't talked about is, of course, that you're famous for being a Limerick man. And this brings us what you've written down for you, the best gig that you were at. Tell us about that.
When I was nine, my dad took me to hear this thing down at the Savoy Cinema in Limerick, which was also a great theatre, unfortunately gone. But there was a band playing there called the Golden City Dixies. And they were a band out of South Africa. They came originally from Durban, a completely black band. And there were about 30 of them on the stage. And they were just, it just blew me away. The standard of musicianship, the standard of singing, performance. I just remember at 9 years of age, my dad went up afterwards and went to the pit in the Savoy in Limerick, where his pal, an old buddy of his, was recording the thing. And he said, to any chance of a copy of that? And he said, sure, yeah. And the next day we had a copy of the concert from the previous night. And when I was nine, I learnt all of the songs, including South African Zulu songs. I learnt them phonetically. I was totally blown away by it, by the standard of playing and everything.
I know. Well, listen, there weren't many video cameras in the Savoy in Limerick in 1959. Yeah. Not too many Zulus either. But we found this performance by the Golden City Dixies on YouTube. It's from 1959 in Stockholm.
Goodness.
Thank you. It's the Golden City Dixies, as they would have sounded in the Savoy in Limerick 1959. Can you vouch for that?
Yeah, I can vouch for that. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
We are down to now, let me see. We're down to your favourite movie actor or director. And what have you chosen?
Oh, this is impossible. But anyway, yeah. I had a shot at it. Mm. And it's a recent movie. Although it's probably been bypassed by another one since, but an Irish movie. But this movie has an Irish dimension because of the produced by Irish company in part. But it's Poor Things, which is directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. And it starred Emma Stone, who won an Oscar for her performance, and Mark Ruffalo and Willem Dafoe. And it's an extraordinary film in that it is completely, it's very visually so beautiful. It's bizarre. I mean, it's a long and bizarre film in many ways. But I just the whole atmosphere that Lanthimos created in the film, you know, stayed with me for weeks afterwards. And then I sought out the book, and the book was written by a guy called Alistair Gray. He's dead now, but he wrote the book in 1994. The book is slightly different from the film, but neither suffers from having experienced one. You can see the film and read the book. And sometimes when you read a book that you've seen on film, one of them doesn't match up. This is, even though the story is different, it's amazing. And I love this film. But then, since then, I was just thinking about Pat Collins' film, As They Face the Rising Sun. Okay. Now, there's a film, you know, nothing happens. It's extraordinary. Looks so beautiful. But anyway, Poor Things was my choice for this.
Let's take a clip from Poor Things.
These two are fighting and ideas are banging around in Bella's head and heart like lights in a storm.
Oh. You're always reading now, Bella. You're losing some of your adorable way of speaking.
I'm a changeable feast, as are all of we. Apparently, according to Emerson, disagreed with by Harry.
Come, come, just come.
You were in my son.
What?
That was Mark Ruffalo and Emma Stone, of course, in Poor Things. I presume the company you're talking about is Element, is it? And,
yeah.
And the other film was Colleen Kuhn, was it?
No, the other film was As They Face the Rising Sun.
But the one that they did.
Oh, yeah. Colleen Kuhn, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Listen, the play you've picked is brilliant because, I mean, it's a great play by Arthur Miller, but it couldn't be more relevant to the world we live in today.
Exactly.
And tell us about that play.
Well, it's for the reasons that you just mentioned. It is, even though it was written some time ago, it is a very, very relevant play. I had the misfortune of seeing a production of it in New York directed by Ivo van Hove. And it starred Saoirse Ronan and a brilliant performance by Ciarán Hinds and Bill Camp, two great actors. But it was... it was almost like Disney meets this story. And this story is so dark and it's so internal and it's so full of suspicion in all the minds and the hearts of these people in a small community who are ready to believe anything about, you know, witchcraft and all of that.
The Crucible.
Yeah.
And it's never been so apt as it is today.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great, great play.
Hysteria.
Yeah.
Cancellation.
Yeah.
Vilification.
Yeah.
Accusing people of, being all sorts of things. People, no sense of nuance. You're either in or you're out. You either say yes, damned, or not.
And there were plenty of people, as there are now, waiting to, you know, exercise that point, finger pointing, you know, that cancelling, that everything that we see going on today, and particularly in the political world and via the internet. I don't know if you saw Elon Musk and Trump the other night.
Yeah, we covered it last night.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know where we're going with all of this. So we really need to kind of smarten up. I don't know if Kamala and Tim are going to make a difference in the long run. I heard somebody saying this morning that they're a honeymoon, but then the honeymoon will be over and it's a couple of months to November. Mm. Let's see.
It's also unlikely Trump will ever see a version of The Crucible. But anyway, let's imagine he did, because this is what he would see.
What do we do? The village is out. I just come from the farm. The whole country's talking witchcraft. They'll be calling us witches, Abby.
They'll be calling us witches, Abby. She means to tell. I know it.
Abby, we've got to tell. Witchery's a hanging error. A hanging like they done in Boston 2 years ago. We must tell the truth, Abby. You'll only be whipped for the dancing and the other thing.
Oh, we'll be whipped.
I never done none of it, Abby. I only looked.
Oh, you're a great one for looking, aren't you, Mary Warren? What a grand peeping courage you
Betty,
have.
Now, Betty, dear, wake up. It's Abigail. I'll beat you, Betty. You seem improving. I talked to your papa. I told him everything, so there's nothing to be afraid of.
I want my mama.
What ails you? Betty, your mama's dead and buried.
I'll fly to mama. Let me fly.
I told him everything. He knows now. He knows everything we did.
Drank blood, Abby. You didn't tell him that.
Betty. You never say that again. You never say that again.
You did. You drank and tried to kill John Foster's wife. You drank and tried to kill Lady Foster.
Shut it now. Shut it.
Mama.
Now look, you, all of you. We danced and Tituba conjured Ruth Putnam's dead sisters, and that is all. And mark this, let either of you breathe a word or the edge of a word about the other things, and I will come to you in the black of some terrible night, and I will bring a pointy reckoning that will shudder you.
That's a clip of Arthur Miller's The Crucible performed by the National Theatre in London. Do you know what I haven't asked you about, and you didn't even fill this out, I don't know if you know who we're giving it, but TV, Bill. Has TV been, I mean, you grew up in a TV world. I mean,
oh, I did. I filled out my favourite TV show.
Oh, what did you say there?
I said it was The Dry.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's a subject that I know a little bit about, and it's the whole thing of addiction. But I just loved, I loved the fact that the character played brilliantly by Roisin Gallagher. You know, the recently dried abuser of alcohol who comes home to her family and wants to kind of change them all. And she kind of, by being there, she suddenly reveals a whole load of stuff about the family that had never been revealed before. But it's very funny. It's written, it's a series, into a second season, and written by Nancy Harris. It's very funny, but it actually is right on. It really, I think she deals with the subject with such sensitivity. It's fantastic.
Good, and credit to RTE as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So it's done well. I think, do we have a clip of The Dry? Let's hear a clip of The Dry.
Ah, shit.
Dad. Sweetheart, did you just get in?
Caroline forgot to collect me.
Oh, no.
I was doing everything else.
What happened here?
Oh, just a little fall. Caroline fixed me up.
You've lost weight.
No, I haven't.
You have, hasn't she, Bernie?
You look great. And your skin.
Gorgeous.
Miss Huff.
No, it's suiting you, this new lifestyle. Isn't it, Bernie? How long has it been?
5 months, 17 days and 6 hours.
Wow. No, that is...
Very promising. She in there? She wanted to be waked. I was thinking, if it's okay, I'd like to say something at the funeral.
About what?
Granny.
Oh, I don't think there'd be any need for that. Do you think there'd be any need for that, Tom?
No, God, no.
I'm not going to be embarrassing. She's been really good to me these last few months, you know? Her support.
Of course, yeah. And we're here to support you too this weekend, aren't we, Tom?
Absolutely, yeah. Very much here too.
Right, we're going to go to the shops.
For what?
Food.
You don't have any.
I'm off gluten and dairy too.
Oh, f*** sake.
What?
Why don't you go with them and get what you need?
I haven't seen Granny yet.
Well, it's not like she's going anywhere, is it?
Among others, I think that was Roisin Gallagher, and I think I could hear Kieran Hines in the background as well. We're going to finish with your buried treasure, Bill, and this is either a song, a band, painting, podcast, book, movie, TV show, etc., that you think a lot more people should know about. And there's a Limerick connection here.
Yeah, I chose something that has been lived with me since the first moment I heard it, is Jimmy Webb's MacArthur Park, which he wrote for Richard Harris.
A Limerick Man.
A Limerick Man. And it was, you know, again, it was one of those moments that first time I heard it, I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't. Here was like a 7 or 7.5 or 8 minute song with a big instrumental bit in the middle and a sort of a very much an actorly performance. You know, not like a wandering star. This was a real actorly performance and a great lyric and beautiful orchestration. And I played it endlessly when I was about 17 or 18 when I heard it first.
And didn't you work with Richard Harris as well?
I did.
What, tell us what you did with him.
Yeah, I wrote the music for a film that I wrote the theme for a film that he did called Bloomfield. And that kind of drew me even closer to Webb. And then Jimmy Webb and I got to meet and we've remained friends over years. But he's he is, in a, you know, he wrote songs like Wichita Lineman.
Oh, brilliant.
By the Time I Get to Phoenix.
Oh, yeah.
Up, Up and Away, Galveston, all those hits.
And Ben Campbell.
He wrote MacArthur Park when he was 21.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a major piece of work. And people joke about the lyric about someone left the cake out in the rain. But then I think Donna Summer did a kind of disco version.
I love that. I love that Donna Summer version. Let's hear the Richard Harris version.
Spring was never waiting for us, girl. It ran one step ahead as we followed in the dance. Between the parted pages and repressed in love's hot fevered iron, like a striped pair of pants. MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it.
Richard Harris had a voice.
He did, yeah.
Not bad at all.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I preferred Diana Ross's what's her name?
Yeah, Donna Summer.
Donna Summer's version.
Yeah.
There he is, hitting the high note.
He got a bit of help on the last note, I think. But it's a great arrangement, you know.
Yeah. Bill, what's next for you? What are you doing at the moment?
Well, actually, right now I'm doing a little bit of, I'm having some fun playing around with a couple of great musician friends of mine. I've been doing some stuff. I just did a big concert at the National Concert Hall with the National Symphony. Next weekend, I'm going up to Carlingford to play with Zoe Conway and John. And then I'm going to Bantry after that with Martin Hayes the following weekend as part of his Masters of Tradition that he does every year. And we're there, I think the thing goes on for about 5 days. A great festival. So Martin and I are maybe playing a bit. I'm also going to play with two other great musicians that I've worked with, Seamus and Caoimhe O'Flaherty. And they are just two young Shano singers, brilliant players. And we'd probably do something as well. That's it. So busy.
Bill Whelan, it's been an absolute pleasure catching up with you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.